Welcome everyone to the first episode of Identity International's second webinar series, Palestinian Beyond Conflict. This series will be running throughout the month of December on Wednesdays and Saturdays at 5 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, where we will delve into the evolution of Palestinian identity with our esteemed guests. To receive notifications and updates regarding the series, please follow our social media platforms. And if you miss any of our episodes, please check them out on YouTube. Today, we will be in conversation with Dr. Ramzi Barood. Ramzi is a US-Palestinian journalist, author, internationally syndicated columnist, and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He is the author of 5 books and a contributor of many others. His latest volume is These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. His work has been published in hundreds of newspapers and journals worldwide, including the Washington Post and Al Jazeera. Ramzi has a PhD in Palestinian Studies from the University of Exeter and was a non-resident scholar at the Orfalea Center for Global and International Studies, University of California, Santa Barbara. Currently, he's a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center of Islam and Global Affairs and Istanbul Zain University. Ramzi, thank you so much today for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The first question I would like to pose to you, and this has been the theme of our series throughout, and it's going to be, what does it mean to you personally to be Palestinian?
Right. So as simple as this question may seem, is actually quite difficult to answer, because I feel like we, for so many years, we have been caught in the definitions of others and of how the world and others perceive us, whether as victims, as terrorists, as heroes, and so forth and so on. At the end of the day, all of these definitions tend to be quite dehumanizing. But that's not the real problem. The real problem is that we became so familiar with this discourse to the point that we have developed this kind of identity that that attempts at countering the perception of us as in certain ways. So we are constantly, or we have always been really kind of on the defensive, trying to prove that we are not this or that. We are not victims. We are not terrorists. We are not anything else. But in the process of doing so, we almost failed at defining who we are thoroughly, independently from Israel, from Zionism, from Arab countries' perceptions, from the world's perception, from mainstream media's perception, and so forth. If we are to liberate ourselves from these kind of layers of misconceptions, it really goes back to this. For me, being a Palestinian is being born to a family of Palestinian peasants that comes back from southern Palestine, where we owned a small piece of land. We were not wealthy or anything. And at one point, there was this interruption in our existence. We existed for many, many generations in southern Palestine. We survived despite of all the hardships of life under various invasions and occupations, but also under the hardships of changing weathers and poverty and circumstances that were out of our control. And that solidified our relationship to our land. This is why the word "ard," land in Palestine, has quite a different meaning than the word "ard," land, in the perception of landowners or farmers or peasants in many parts of the world. It's a whole different relationship. In fact, we have saying, that kind of really that when it tries to prioritize, what are the most important elements in our existence? Usually the word "ard," land, comes first, but not in the material and materialistic sense as land in terms of power or in terms of currency or in terms of wealth, but rather land in terms of an intimate relationship in which we see the land as akin, as a, as family, as community, as history, as culture, as, you know, so much more, personal and collective relationship to the land. And even though I was born and raised in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, I still kind of inherited this. My grandfather spoke about the land all the time, the land that we left behind, the land that is ours, the land that we have been deprived from. So I grew up with the concept of land and land ownership, again, not in a materialistic sense, but in a whole different identity sense, despite the fact that we had no land and we were refugees and we were struggling to even maintain that refugee status. So I see myself as a Palestinian in my relationship with my land that encompasses so much more. It encompasses the history of my grandparents as peasants that fought hard to keep their dignity and their land, their karama, their self-respect. And my father, who became a freedom fighter in the 50s and 60s, my mother, who was, although she was illiterate, she had profound influence on my character, on all of us, really, because she was the rapport between us and the past, and of course, on this generation of Palestinians who are still fighting for the same ideas, for the same conceptions, and for the same relationships that we have been deprived from for such a long time.
No, that's really insightful. And the particular land that you hail from, if I'm correct, is a village that no longer can be seen on the map. It's Beit Taras. And I saw you do an interview on that and how it was a very insightful interview. And I think it would be relevant to our viewers today as well. If you could highlight what the village has come to mean to you across generations, and how that sort of shapes your identity and your, you know, your take on Palestine.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting because I've never seen Beit Taras in my life. Or to be a bit more precise, at one point during a school trip when we were allowed to visit historic Palestine when we were children, I was in the third grade. And I remember my geography, also math and PE teacher, Mohammed Diab, called me as we were passing in an area near Asqalan, today's Ashkelon, and he yelled, he said, "Who is from Beit Taras?" And I raised my hand, and he said, "Come over here." And then he pointed at the horizon where there were, like, you know, quite a foresty area all the way back in the horizon, and he said, "Over there, beyond these trees, your grandfather owned a piece of land there. That's Beit Taras." And I just very quickly, really, it was a split second, I just saw that, and then the kind of the bus passed that area into a populated area, buildings, skyscrapers covered the horizon, and it registered in my head all of these years ago that this is Beit Taras. And really that second kind of even cemented the idea of what Beit Taras is. Now, the interesting thing is that, and I know from experience, from numerous interviews, discussions, that this is the kind of relationship that the vast majority of Palestinian refugees, have towards their own Beit Taras, whether Masmiya or Batani or Hamame or Julis or the other 500 Palestinian villages and localities that were destroyed during the Nakba, the catastrophic destruction of the Palestinian homeland, have maybe their own personal takes and interpretations, but ultimately it's the same collective experience. Now, what I find interesting is that also Beit Taras has changed in my mind in throughout the years. As a child, I saw Beit Taras as an actual physical entity that I escaped to when life was very harsh in the refugee camp. And life in the refugee camp was really and remains very, very difficult, not just because of the, constant state of war and killing and that imposed by the Israeli occupation, but also the poverty, the isolation, the want, the constant want the constant feeling of threat, that you're always on the brink. You are always at a point of existence in which that as bad as things are now, they could actually at any given moment, within a day, within an hour, could become a lot worse. That emotional instability, you know, which still exists until this day, kind of forced us to think of this happy place that we always escape to. And this is why the right of return is much more complex than just going back to our villages and claiming our lost villages and land. But it has also a psychological component in the mind of the Palestinian refugee, is our collective happy place. So I ran away to Beit Daras whenever I wanted to believe that things, you know, must get better, that getting, you know, for things to get worse cannot be the only option in this life and this existence. But as I grew older, I began seeing that piece of land. And again, you know, a lot of Palestinians, and this is kind of something that we laugh about in private companies, tell you, oh, back in the day, we had this massive piece of land. You know, we used to make fun of, especially older people who would say things like, my land was so great that I would, you know, if you take a horse at dawn and ride it all the way, you would not reach the inn by sunset. And we kind of, you know, laugh at the concept because, of course, we were poor peasants and we owned tiny, small pieces of land, and most of us did, and many peasants worked in other people's, you know, we had a feudalistic system at the time, and many peasants worked in other people's lands and they did not have their own land. But suddenly that piece of land in my mind grew at a psychological level to represent something much bigger. I am sure at my current financial capacity, I can buy a larger piece of land than the one that my grandfather left to, should be about 150, 200 people at this point. So it's not that piece of land that we are fighting for. It's for the representation of that piece of land. The fact that that piece of land for us represents dignity, identity, culture, hope, and our political rights, our legal and political rights as enshrined under international law. And to let go of that is to let go of everything. It's not about failing to let go of the past. It's about refusing to let go of our last claim and attempt at restoring a degree of justice. This is what Beit Daras has become to me. And that split second of seeing Beit Daras as a physical entity manifesting itself before my very eyes now means something far more complex at every possible level, physical, material, but also political, legal, and also that of my identity, my personality, myself as a human being, and the legacy I intend to leave for my children, you know, once I pass on.
Which is a lot more complex than the simplified and victimized representation that Palestinians definitely only get in the mainstream. You know, they are often shown as just statistics, or you know, you hear odd, in the odd case, you may hear more about the story here and there, but often it is just reduced down. You know, none of this is actually said or stated in mainstream media.
And this is why, if I may add something to that, I feel like even us Palestinians, we kind of fell into the trap of trying to identify the right of return and what it means purely from a legal and a political perspective. You know, international law, UN resolutions and how they are relevant and all of this, which is important. It's very important, but it's not the whole story. And this is why also I resorted to a whole different narration of history through history from below or people's history by saying, no, maybe for the intellectual, for the legal expert, for the politician, these are the relative or the relevant rather identifiers of the right of return. But for the average Palestinian refugee, there is a whole new component or many new components that you are not familiar with. And only they can actually speak about these components and what they mean to them. And this is why, you know, there is now a new school of Palestinian thoughts in history that is kind of trying to find alternative histories to tell the story of Palestine through the Palestinians themselves. And all my books really have been, and my attempt at contributing to this new school of thoughts that is, in my opinion, is at this point is quite thriving.
Yes, no, and we've noticed that, especially in your books with the latest book that you published, These Chains Will Be Broken. You've shown how Palestinian prisoners within Israeli jails have, you know, their own story. And you've tried to show that outside of a political context, whilst obviously respecting the politics and the position that they're in, but you want to hear their personal stories and how, you know, exactly. And that has, you know, it's come across very well in your book. Whilst you were carrying those interviews out, you know, how did you manage to pull those people out of that mindset that they're sort of surrounded with, you know, all the time?
Absolutely. It's a quite a challenge because, as I said in the beginning, we are trained to respond in a certain way. So when a prisoner is being approached by someone saying, you know, my name is this and that, and I am based in London or Seattle or Istanbul or what have you, the immediately kind of, you know, spontaneous reaction to, you know, this is what the Israelis have done to me, and this is what I, you know, you kind of deceive themselves as political agents and political agents only, part of a larger discourse in which they can't really influence or control. So the idea is, how do you liberate them entirely and completely and say, no, you don't have to see yourself as a reaction to anybody else's action. You don't have to see yourself as someone in a state of self-defense. This is of no interest to me. I want you to see yourself as the center of history. You, your wife, your children, your family, your community, your village, your refugee camp, you are the core of history. You are the storyteller, and you are no longer bound by these other identifiers. It doesn't always work. And I've kind of struggled with that immensely, really. Like my previous book, The Last Earth, A Palestinian Story, which was a story of 8 different individuals, but was based on interviews of nearly 150 to 170 different individuals. Many of them, no matter how much we try to kind of get them to that state of mind, of you are not a response to anybody else's discourse, you are the discourse, you are the creator of your own story. Many of them couldn't, and it was sad that they couldn't, because they are not trained to see themselves that way. So there were so many political diatribes and speeches and slogans, and despite the fact that the stories behind them were quite powerful. So at times we failed, we succeeded in extracting the story, and at times we failed. In this last book, I approached differently. We spoke to many prisoners, and the question that we asked was not a political question. It was about, if there is a story that define you, a moment, it could be an actual moment, it could be a day or two or a whole life experience that feels it's something that defines who you are as a human being. As a brother, as a son, as a friend, as a husband, as a wife, as a political agent, whatever that moment is, what is it? Elaborate on it in any way you find suitable. And we kind of extracted, some of them were interviews, some of them were stories written directly, and we edited and, you know, and expounded on the stories, and others were communicated verbally, because some people are brilliant storytellers. They are not good writers, but they are absolutely brilliant storytellers. So we kind of used every possible medium to extract these stories. And then we would get back to them and talk to them about the way we understood their stories to ensure that we are not misreading these stories. Now, the challenge after that is, how do you create that kind of common thread between all these stories? And, you know, the common thread is always there. At one particular moment, I decided to bring 3 people whose stories have been told in these books, in this book, and to bring them together, to have a conversation with each other, to really see, have we succeeded indeed in identifying the common threat in the Palestinian narrative, particularly regarding the issue of prisoners. So it happened that the 3 of them were at a conference in Istanbul. Mm-hmm. And we brought them together in a cafeteria and we sat and we had a conversation. And the interesting thing that each one of these individuals come from a different political group, Fatah, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad. So you would think that there is enough political, bad blood, so to speak, between them that they couldn't really find common ground. But once they began talking, and then they realized that they were actually interrogated and tortured by the same people, and then they stayed in the same rooms during their interrogation process. And then suddenly you kind of see this kind of camaraderie and that this brotherhood kind of growing amongst them. And that kind of odd feeling and discomfort that they felt in the beginning was replaced with tears and hugs and promises to stay in touch at the end, kind of really confirmed that ultimately beneath the surface of Palestinian disunity and factionalism and all of this, the Palestinian story is essentially one and the same. And I think that's the responsibility of the people's historian to be able to actually help the people find that common ground once more. They already have it. It's just they have been distracted by it for so many different reasons. It's your responsibility to unearth it, present it to them first and to the reader second, as indeed the common Palestinian discourse and the common Palestinian narrative.
That's very interesting, especially considering how divisive and factionalized, especially politically factionalized, and people are pitted against each other often. And this is seen throughout conflict zones where you have, ideological discourse taking over the entirety of the narrative and you don't have the actual people's voices and the stories that they have, which they have so much in common regarding, coming to the surface and realizing that we are in this together and we're all trying to ultimately achieve the same aim.
And there is this misunderstanding. Some people are under the impression that people's history is a sentimental issue. It's about giving people the voice. They deserve the right to speak. It's not that. It is far more effective and functional history because it allows us to imagine alternative scenarios to the present and the future. It allows us to unearth these powers that we have as people that we have neglected, but it's there. And once we reimagine and see ourselves in this whole different narrative and different perspective, we could, in fact, in retrospect, start working on our political dysfunctionalities and factionalism. So it has a practical value and meaning. And one last thing I'd like to say about it is that people's history is the most accurate way of telling history, the most accurate, because elitist history, what in academia they called back in the day, the great man's theory, that only great people make history. So when you imagine the history of Palestine, you always think of Yasser Arafat, Ahmad Yassin and so forth. But that is not the true representation of Palestinian history. The Palestinian history is a collective history. We are all participants in that history. We all made that history together. The challenge is, how do we present a history that indeed reflects that collective reality? It's not an easy job. But again, it's not a sentimental history. It's not about just really feeling good about ourselves that we gave the common man and woman the chance to tell their story. It is far more effective way of imagining the past and also imagining the future as well.
We're on that note, with your, on a personal, more personal level, what would you say is your story to tell in this and what you hope that your future generations have to tell in this?
Back in the day, I used to, not just me, but lots of kids in my refugee camp, we used to always think that we were unfortunate to be born in this reality. Refugees, descendants of refugees, lining up before, some humanitarian organization's tent somewhere, mostly UNRWA, collecting flowers, sugars, discarded jackets and pants and shoes that are tossed at us from some nation somewhere in the world. That humiliation of living this kind of life, lack of opportunities, lack of horizon, they always speak about political horizons, but rarely do they actually speak about individual horizons and communal horizons. You know, that hope that we all need in any polity, in any scenario, in any landscape, anywhere in the world, we all need hope in order for us to wake up in the morning and to operate as human beings and to carry on and to build something and make something of ourselves, and to have none of that. It was an unfortunate reality, and obviously many of us would kind of, you know, watching TV, you know, reading newspapers, and you hear about how other people in other parts of the world are living, that it's not really a status quo to be a refugee. It's really not a normal thing to be chased by Israeli soldiers every day out of your classroom, or to see your father being beaten up by soldiers every time they invade your house, or to lose loved ones and to have a martyr's graveyard. You know, this is not a concept that is common everywhere in the world, the martyr's graveyard, where you would go every Thursday with, you know, the Holy Quran to read verses from the Quran for those who died. It's not normal. This is not a normal life. But later in life, I began realizing, yes, it's horrific. It's terrible. Nobody should be exposed to this kind of reality. But in many ways, it also kind of, you start appreciating a lot of things about that. The fact that we don't take things for granted. The fact that we see ourselves as part of change that happens, even that should happen beyond your immediate entity and polity and locality. That you see yourself an advocate for justice, truly, not as an intellectual concept, you know, to be thrown around in some academic conference that is devoid of meaning, but actually has real, tangible meaning, because you saw in everyday reality what injustice is and feels like. To speak about freedom, not as a conception, but as an everyday reality, but you, because you saw what lack of freedom is like. And I think in many ways, it's really cemented our identities and our personalities, and especially my generation, the Intifada generation. We lived during the 1987 Palestinian uprising, and it was one of the most beautiful movements, I think, in our collective history as Palestinians. Not because we believe that an intifada or an uprising is going to liberate the homeland. No, I don't think we really had any particular illusions about this. This is why when I hear people say, you know, talking about there is a need for a third Palestinian intifada, or is this the third Palestinian intifada? I feel like they are really missing the point. Intifadas are not about the liberation of land. It's about the liberation of the self. It's about the communal initiative that you are not at the receiving end of victimization. You are not just a hapless person standing in front of a United Nations charity line waiting for your ration of sugar and flour and jackets. You are a political agent, and you are strong, and you are determined, and you are part of a real change in society. And you have ideas, and you have the capacity to mobilize and to organize and to defeat the stratagems of your enemy, no matter how strong that enemy is. It really is about self-empowerment. And I noticed that generation that lived the Intifada 1987 until 1993, wherever they are in the world, you run to them, you meet them, and you talk to them, and you realize that empowerment that was created in us during that particular stage in our lives still exists in them. As human beings, as fathers and mothers, as individuals. So that was really quite powerful. And so back to my initial point, going back and looking back at all of this, while you still recognize the injustice of it all, you still appreciate the fact that this hardship cemented you and your personality and your identity as a human being and prepared you for the world at large. And, you know, I know it's easy said than done, but I feel like if I am to relive that experience, I would relive it. This time knowing that it was part of a greater design, and you know, for you as a person and as a community, Palestinians are not exceptional in terms of, you know, their DNA or their genetics and so forth. but they are exceptional in terms of the experiences that they have lived. And because of the kind of, you know, this kind of relentless pressure that never goes away, that never subsides, that there are no breaks, no breathing room. There's one challenge after the other, after the other. And I think that's what makes us exceptional in a sense, that made us stronger and more durable and ready for any possibility and is allowing us to carry on without, you know, ever using the word surrender. Surrender is just not part of our vocabulary. It's not part of our lexicon. Maybe, yes, we have leadership that is compromising and selling out. That's a whole different issue. But as people, as nation, there is something in us victorious in our collective personality that would never, ever allow us or give us the space to ever surrender under any circumstance.
And in your kind of view, how do you see this collective sort of Palestinian identity evolving for the next? I mean, obviously this might be a bit prophetic, but still evolving, considering that the it's sort of getting worse in terms of normalization on the part, you know, on the part of like the other Arab Muslim majority nations within the region, and that being accelerated, especially this year, and the Abrahamic Accords and the way that the Trump administration had handled Palestine. How do you see this collective identity evolving within all these struggles for the future?
Right. So since we were little kids in occupied Palestine, we've always heard our grandparents and our parents watching the news and constantly cursing Arab rulers, al-hukam al-Arab. I've heard the cursing of Arab rulers quite often, even more than the cursing of the Zionists, because the Zionists were, you know, doing what a colonial regime would do.
Yes.
They are just following the blueprint of how colonialism works. Ethnic cleansing, genocide, murder, that sort of thing. So we kind of had a very clear relationship with Israel. They knew who they are, we knew who we are, and we knew the nature of our conflict with them. The problem we had, the bigger and more complex problem, is with Arab rulers, because we were raised in a society in which we believe that we are one Arab nation and one Muslim ummah. And therefore, it's the responsibility of that larger nation and that larger ummah to come to the rescue of those who are in need. Yet in actuality, rarely we actually felt that solidarity, because the Arab people are equally oppressed in different political landscapes. So they couldn't really come to the rescue. And Arab rulers are constantly selling out, falling within, you know, the traps of American political schemes and American foreign policy and so forth, but constantly paying lip service to the Palestinian cause. You listen to a king or a prince or a president or an emir somewhere, and you kind of get this impression that they really seem to be very determined to liberate Palestine. It's really all about time, you know. It's a matter of time. Just be patient. The Arab armies are coming. It's, you know, they're just working the details of that liberation of Palestine. And then you go through that experience long enough that there is this collective awareness. Everybody knows it, that this is a lie. It's fraud. They are using Palestine. They are exploiting Palestine. They are hiding behind the liberation of Palestine, perhaps to oppress their own people or to justify their own political legitimacy, because they have none, frankly. While Palestinians, with time, we learned to just look and nod, you know, at their conferences, the Arab summits here and there, and listening to their speeches, just shaking our heads, we know that nothing good will come out of it. So when the normalization happened, Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and others, we've already beyond that. I mean, we've already established that we had really no expectations from these people. If we had any expectations, it would have been at least don't sell out completely. At least take a neutral position. You don't have to come and solidify with us. You know, we know that we have been largely on our own for such a long time that we were not really expecting the Bahraini army to come. But at least don't normalize. You know, do not invest in Israeli racism, in Israeli sports racism, like Emirates is buying, you know, shares in the Israeli Israel, Bitar Jerusalem, and a very notorious racist football club, don't invest in Israeli racism at least. But even that seemingly simple demand wasn't met. But I don't think really at a collective emotional level, as Palestinians, there is a state of shock. I don't think there is a state of shock. If it's anything, it's a moment of, I told you so. Al-Hukam al-Arab, the Arab rulers, have always been traitors. And they've always valued their interest far above, not just the interest of the Palestinian people, but the interest of their own people as well. Now, the challenge now that we are now, that realization is happening, in being confirmed and cannot be denied by anyone, even the most optimistic among Palestinians. The question is, what do we do now with this realization? I think we have already been investing in a global solidarity movement, and it's been happening for quite some time now. And I think we are several steps and leaps forward in this investment, that we know that without having a global solidarity with the Palestinian cause, and without investing in civil society, and without using civil society as the ambassadors of the Palestinian quest for freedom, not the Arab rulers, but civil societies throughout the world at equal footage everywhere, as our ambassadors in this fight for freedom and justice, our cause is not going to go anywhere. And now I feel like if it's anything, now we are investing more and more in this direction. I personally have been one of many who have been venturing out to new political landscapes in Africa, for example. Just last year alone, I was in several African countries. The latest was Kenya, trying to engage with civil societies, with academics, with journalists, with politicians and parliamentarians, to talk to them about Palestine and to see how can we actually build real practical solidarity between our nations in order for them and us to advance our mutual causes. We are investing more in intersectionality. Just prior to this discussion, I was talking to colleagues from South America and Latin America in a conference talking about kind of imagining a future that is better for all of us and so forth. So if anything, it confirms our understanding of the past and the fact that we need to venture out to a global political space, not just to be confined to these political platitudes that have been paid to us by Arab rulers for many years and never really translated to anything tangible.
Great. Thank you for answering that. Now I'm going to open up the questions to the audience just to see, and we already have one in place. It's someone's asking, don't you think accords like Abraham Accords harm the cause of Palestine in the past? Although tell us current Arab-Israeli deal affects on tell us the current Arab-Israeli deal and its effects on the Palestinian people and their cause, which is something that you have just briefly covered. But I mean, if you would like to comment on that question.
Of course. I mean, any act of normalization by Arabs and others with Israel is going to harm the Palestinian cause and is harming the Palestinian cause. Because from the very, very start, there has been the nature of the conflict is not just translated on the ground in terms of armed Israeli soldiers and Palestinians resisting in various means. There have been other manifestations to this conflict. On one hand, the Palestinians are trying to expose and delegitimize the Israeli occupation and the Israeli apartheid. On the other hand, Israel has been trying to achieve two things. Present itself as a normal country, a normal democracy, thriving, building economic infrastructures, contributing to the world and so forth, while at the same time trying to marginalize and keep out of the picture entirely the fact that it is a system that is sustained through military occupation, racism, and apartheid. If you normalize with this regime, you are advancing the Israeli agenda, that Israel is a normal polity and everything is fine. And we can live with the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and Israel can be okay, accepted as a member of the international community and integrated into the larger, Arab political region as a normal economy and a contributor to the world, despite the fact that it's an apartheid racist regime. So there's no doubt about it. These kind of normalization agreements are great harm to Palestine and a great advancement to the Zionist and Israeli agenda. But on the other hand, if we are to assist this in terms of the politics of of Palestine itself, Palestine has been divided. Forget about the Hamas Fatah and this kind of factionalism. But in terms of a people, we have been divided to two cultures in Palestine. One very, very tiny culture, it's the Oslo culture. The idea that, listen, we have lost this fight. The most we can expect is few handouts from the US and its rich allies and, you know, some sort of an entity, an autonomous Palestinian region that would allow us to have sports team, a national anthem and a flag. But don't expect much more than that. And the vast majority of Palestinians, on the other hand, or on the other side of this equation, who have always been aware that under no circumstance they can compromise on their rights, their basic, fundamental, internationally enshrined human rights, the concept of justice, equality, socioeconomic, political equality. We have never compromised on that, and I don't think there will ever be a point in which the Palestinian people will ever compromise on these issues. Now, accords or no accords, normalization or no normalization, it's not, none of this is going to seep into our collective psyche. None of this is going to change our relationship with our objectives and our rights and our awareness of these rights. And the reason, just to demonstrate this, Egypt has already normalized with Israel in 1978-79 with the Camp David's Accords. And this is the most popular, populist and influential Arab country at the time and, in fact, until now. And it's a neighbor of Palestine. But two things haven't been achieved in those last 40 years. The Egyptian people never normalized. Their governments, their dictators, their political elites, to some extent, normalized. But the Egyptian people never normalized at all. In fact, there was just a recent example of a popular Egyptian actor who took a selfie, just a single selfie, with an Israeli singer in Dubai, I believe, just a few days ago, and put it on his Instagram. Later on, he claimed that he did not know that this is an Israeli. You should have just seen the popular reaction in Egypt. He has been expelled from the Actors Union, the Egyptian people on social media. That popular actor has been completely erased from the love and the respect of his people. 40 years after normalization, the most popular and populist Arab country failed to even achieve a single selfie between an Egyptian actor and an Israeli singer. Now, why would the far less popular, removed, marginal Arab countries like Bahrain and United Arab Emirates have really any fundamental change in, as far as popular normalization between Arab peoples and Israel and in the Palestinian people's relationship with their larger Arab community and their own relationship with their own cause? So I really don't see any actual effect, practical effect on Palestine and the Palestinian people. To the contrary, it will be these countries and these rulers and the political elites who will normalize are the ones who are going to grow isolated. Palestine stays, and the normalizers will be marginalized as they have already been marginalized by Arab and Muslim people all around the world.
Thank you for that. Another question, well, two questions have popped up. Can you comment on the notion of an Abrahamic federation where the Zionist project is trying to present itself as an indigenous part of the region and the use of the term Abrahamic in the Trump normalization plan? And the second part to that question was, can you comment on the role of China and Russia in the Palestinian struggle for liberation in a changing world order?
This is a really brilliant question. This idea about Israel being an integral part of the Middle East is very, very interesting, actually, because when you think about it, Israel has always presented itself to the West as a member of a larger Western community, a member of the civilized world, a member of the democratic countries club, sort of thing. And they continue to play this card all the time. And when the 9/11 and the post 9/11 period happened, they shifted slightly and they presented themselves as also a victim of terrorism, like the West is, and they are the defenders of civilization and democracy against Islamic terror in the Middle East and so forth. So very, very clever, but not clever enough. I will tell you why in a second. So this whole notion that now they are selling themselves to the Arabs, we're just like you. We have so much in common. Many of our own people come from Arab descent and Arab origins, and suddenly they are part of this new narrative where they are members of the indigenous Arab communities. It's just this political notion used to manipulate people. I think the Arab people are way too political and too clever to buy into this nonsense. It's ingrained in us, understanding that our relationship with Israel is that of Western colonial implant in the Arab world. And I don't think this is really going to change until Zionism itself is eradicated and until the people of that region live as equal in one entity. So that is not going to change anything. But one other interesting thing I want to say, because I mentioned my trips to Africa and South America, they are playing the exact same card in these other polities as well. So in Israel, Netanyahu is selling himself as the descendants of the Israelites. You're not going to believe how many questions I got in several African countries, people asking me about, but aren't Israelis the Israelites? They are the people of the book. They are the biblical ancient nations of Israel and Judea. And then suddenly you are seen as the outsider. And as even though you are the indigenous people of that land, I mean, imagine Americans going to North America, telling the indigenous native people that you are outsiders, you come from Asia or somewhere else. We are the ones who, belong in this area, and we have the historic proofs that our ancestors were here first. And by the way, other colonialist regimes actually used that line repeatedly. The Italians used it in Libya, saying that we are the Romans, we belong here, you are Bedouins, you are nomads, you come from the desert somewhere, you have no identity, no nation, no collective background, and so forth and so on. So Israel uses this line quite often. It will fail in the Arab world because at least we got that element right. We know who we are as nations, we know our relationship with our history, with our religions, and so forth. But it is succeeding in other parts of the world, especially in Africa. And this is why it's so very important that we kind of challenge this skewed paradigm and explain to our comrades, sisters, brothers, and friends in Africa and South America and elsewhere that we are, in fact, the indigenous people. And we have that common ground with you. As indigenous people who fought against colonialism, we are also indigenous people fighting against colonialism. The other questions about China and Russia. It's very clear that the world is changing. It's changing in so many different ways, and not because of COVID-19. Way prior to COVID-19, there was a change that was happening in terms of geopolitics in the Middle East and other parts of the world after 2012, when the Americans began withdrawing, retreating out of the Middle East, moving to Asia, redefining the challenge, that the new challenge is now China and Russia. One economically and the other militarily. And that period, they call it the pivot to Asia. Well, that pivot to Asia kind of opened up the political landscape of the Middle East. And it allowed other countries to move in, Russia, China, and others. And of course, Turkey and NATO members, but in their individual capacities, because of the lack of so-called American leadership. So we see France, Italy, and others kind of making individual moves outside of the European Union, outside of NATO, because they are very concerned, and they ought to be, that the Middle East is now a contested landscape as opposed to one that has been dominated by colonial and neo-colonial powers since World War II. Now, I see something positive in that, but we should not exaggerate in our optimism. The positive thing is that we are in a transition. And as you know, Antonio Gramsci, the great Italian anti-fascist intellectual, speaks about these kind of transitions, these interim periods, political interim periods, where he says that the real crisis is that when the old is dying, but the young is failing to be born. And that's the real crisis. And I think we are living in this crisis in the Middle East more than any other region in the world, because the old is indeed dying. But we don't see the region itself kind of culminating a comeback. You are witnessing a new movement in South America, for example. They are aware of the transition and they are trying to kind of diversify their political and economic resources, reaching out to Russia, to China, but in their own terms, not according to Russian Chinese terms. In the Middle East, we don't have that. And that is a problem, because right now we are yet to develop a political entity or a political pact that is aware of the transition and is ready to negotiate a new political and geopolitical contract with these new players. So as a result, we are witnessing a mayhem. I don't know how long this mayhem is going to carry on, but we are in desperate need for alternatives in order for us to actually manage to finally move beyond this chaotic interim period into a period of stability and hope, and greater influence of the people of this region on the political outcomes of the future.
Right. Thank you for that. And thank you so much for giving us that incredible insight throughout the talk. Are there any final closing remarks that you might want to make on the topic of our discussion today, primarily regarding Palestinian identity?
Absolutely. 2-3 days ago was the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People. This day started as a United Nations initiative and for years and years it subsisted as some kind of a platform for political niceties and platitudes as opposed to actual practical action. The good news is that we have reclaimed it, or we are in the process of reclaiming it as people in the Palestine International Solidarity Movement, and the pro-Palestine civil societies, throughout the world, and that's a good thing. And I just want, really, one my main message during this particular week is, let's translate that solidarity, or rather, let's start our process of solidarity with listening to the Palestinian people, appreciating the Palestinian people, not as political pawns, not as part of a larger ideological understanding of the world at large, but really appreciating the uniqueness of the Palestinian people as a people. And this applies to any other nation in the world that is going through a process with a national liberation, or trying to overcome racism, apartheid, inequality, and so forth. Listen to the Palestinian people. Listen to the voices of the Palestinian people. Develop your understanding and your plan for action based on a real, genuine, and authentic understanding of Palestine. Not for Palestinians to be outsiders of their own narratives, but to be at the center, at the core of that narrative as well. Don't judge Palestinians, but try to understand and appreciate why we make the kind of collective decisions that we make. I think that's where really true solidarity starts prospering and leading into something truly meaningful, because we know we need your solidarity. Without it, we will not be able to overcome all of these pressures and challenges on our own. And I would like to thank, of course, Identity International and you, Ms. Bach, personally, for your efforts. And I wish all of your future seminars will be great success, and you are able to reach the audiences that you want to reach and make the difference that you want.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your both joining us today and giving us that incredible insight. Honestly, it's been a very breathtaking take on at Palestine and the entire issue, especially with considering the global context that we're living in at the moment. And I would like to thank our audience for watching. Our next episode will be on Saturday at the same time, where we'll be in conversation with Antoine Saka. And I would like to thank you all again on behalf of Identity International.